This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here at IBM Watson in Boston. I'm talking with John Considine.
Thank you for coming in and talking to me. I'm John Considine. I'm the general manager of IBM's cloud infrastructure. I'm responsible for all of our data centers, our global backbone, and delivering all of our infrastructure and infrastructure services.
You've been spending big recently. You've just announced another huge swathe of data centers across the US in what looks like a complete war to build data center space between different vendors. What is it IBM's targeting in particular in the US?
We just announced four more data centers that we just opened over the last month. And you'll see over the next 12 months, about 14 more data centers across both the US and the rest of the world. It's funny you phrase that as a war for data center space. We don't actually look at it that way, or I don't look at it that way. We are building based on the demand that we're seeing across our customer base and for our internal services. And so what's driving this expansion is actually demand. And then the driving the locality, because you bring up the U.S., driving the locality is a combination of demand and then a little bit of our strategy stepping forward. And so you'll see that the data centers we just opened are more data centers in two of our regions in the U.S., so Dallas and Washington, D.C., and you'll see us roll out data centers in regions across the world. So we'll do two regions in each of the major geos over the next 12 months to address both the capacity demands that we're seeing from our customers, to carry forward on the data locality in the EU. They want the data, they want to keep their data local, but also to allow us and both our customers and our internal services to deploy higher availability solutions. So simultaneous deployment in multiple data centers, so that if we have a fault in a data center, there's a fire, there's a fiber cuts, or you know those other things, that we actually can deliver services that have high resiliency and very high availability.
You position this as demand from customers. Many of those customers already have data center capabilities of their own. What is happening with that? Are they actually retiring those data centers? And if so, why are you not looking to snap those up in a market where it takes so long to build?
Actually, the answer is yes, as you'd suspect, that people are trying to get rid of data centers. And I think it's a simple thing where are you spending your money, where are you spending your time building, operating, updating, modernizing data centers for most businesses doesn't make any sense. The other question about snapping up the data center and the real estate is actually we do debt sometimes for IBM in the broad in terms of outsourcing and the different things that we do. But for cloud, it's something different. Okay, the designs that we're doing on our data centers, the investments, the technology, the densities, we actually do much better actually building in current designs versus taking old designs and try to modernize them. I've been doing this for a while, and I think when you look at most contemporary data center designs, I call them they're the 1990s model, okay? It doesn't sound that long ago, maybe for you and I, but for some folks, 90s seems like quite a long time ago. The design of those data centers were something like 30 watts per square foot in the data center. And at the time, that was pretty good. But now our rack designs are 15, 18, 20 kilowatts at the low end, and then all the way up to 40 kilowatts in a rack. The data centers are physically not designed to handle that kind of density. So you have a couple choices. You seriously reconfigure the data center and how you do your cooling and your management, or you leave really big wide aisles between your rows and rows of gear. So that's not very efficient. And so the work we're doing is really on, I'll call it the modern data center design, much higher power densities and even changes in the architecture. We talk about getting away from raised floor. Blowing cold air up is not a good physics problem, right? What we do in our hot aisle, cold aisle, containment, and different works there, IBM has quite a bit of experience over the years in the data center, and so bringing that technology into a cloud scale, a hyperscale data center, is something we're focused on, and we find it easier to do in kind of new shells and then move forward from there.
That power question is quite important, isn't it? We're seeing a lot of companies trying to move towards renewable as much as they can. There's a lot of confusion for people. The truth is that you're never going to get the renewable where your data centers are. So it's about offset. You pay for a large bunch of renewables somewhere else on the grid and bring it across. The one thing I've never seen is I've never seen IBM's position on when it will look at maybe being 50% renewable energy or 80% renewable energy. And given the speed with which you're building out, I appreciate that makes that a very difficult thing to estimate. What is the position with renewables?
I think IBM is very responsible in the corporate sense here, and the plans and the models around renewable, I have to tell you, I'm not spot on. I can't tell you when we're going to get to 50% across the board, but it is a concern because there's two things that we do here. One is pure renewables, But the other one is efficiency. And that's good for us and good for the environment. So you'll see some of the things that we've been investing in lately is how do we boost the efficiency so we can get more done within the power envelopes we consume. So it's not only the supply side, but it's the draw, the demand side here that we're working on, because then everyone wins. We consume less power, we get more work done per use, we lower the cost for our end users, and actually do more with less.
You talked just now about the new data centers won't just be in the States, they'll be data centers in other parts of the world. Asia's the part of the world where you don't have a huge density. The majority seems to be US and Europe. We know China is a very important market for everybody at the moment, and IBM's had a lot of investment in China, around power in particular, the Open Power Foundation, new partners building chips that we'll see with Power 9, and I'd like to come to that in a minute. What are the plans for expanding in China and around the rest of Asia?
I think if you look at the rollout and our densities across the world, it was, particularly for cloud, is driven by demand. And so we do forward invest quite a bit, but the cloud started in the U.S. and then followed by Europe and then followed by Asia. So I think the backwards look here is a look at how the cloud's actually grown across the world. Now, specifically in Asia, we actually have a number of data centers in Asia already. And you can look back, we just signed a deal with Wanda in China to build out a major cloud presence in mainland China. We already have assets in Hong Kong, we have things in Japan, we have things in Australia, Singapore. We're already invested in the area. And I will tell you, I'm building new data centers in all of those locations. But for China specific, we just announced a major partnership with Wanda to build out the mainland China cloud capabilities. And that's a huge amount of work, but very exciting for us to really get into that market and expand.
One of the announcements that we had with Power 9 was that we're going to see partner chips. Those are chips in particular designed by Chinese partners who brought Chinese numerical units, Chinese language units into the processors. The announcement with Wanda, of course, is separate to that, but how much will those chips coming on stream and going into power devices and then being delivered to Wanda, how much does that tie together for you?
The cool thing about IBM, one of the reasons I'm actually even here, is that global reach and all of those capabilities. And so as we advance our cloud platform, the work that we're doing with the systems group, so not only the cloud group, but the systems group to integrate those power products into our cloud is a huge focus for ours. And there's really a couple interesting facts for that because, as you know, on the power architecture, it's memory bandwidth and then effectively its I.O. bandwidth is super high. And so when we combine that with the accelerators of GPUs, we find some dramatic increases in performance, in price performance, and back to what I was saying before, actually reducing the power loads and everything else. And so the work that we're doing in conjunction with the power teams, the systems teams here, and the cloud is, I think, never been tighter. And so the builds of our clouds, the inclusion of this technology, we're doing quite a bit of work to make the fabric of what we're doing in our cloud more open. And so that's not only open with respect to the broader community and open standards and all of that, but so that we can combine in different architectures. So the power chips themselves, Intel chips, maybe even some of the things we'll see in ARM and some of these other folks, into that same fabric for the cloud. Because one of the focuses we've had on cloud, and it's really been there all along, although I don't know how much people pay attention to it, is we want to provide the platform, we want to provide the environment that lets the businesses get their work done. And instead of what a lot of cloud providers are doing, saying, we built it this way, you come conform to what we do, IBM has come from the flip side of saying, we'll do whatever you want. Now, that's a hard position to be in because the customized world of GTS and SO and all of those other things is almost the antithesis of cloud.
But there's another part to that complexity in that cloud is commoditization. It's the whole Henry Ford argument. You can have as many of these as you want in black.
Yes, any color, as long as it's black.
And once we start with cloud to move to customization rather than configuration, we start to backslide to old habits. We get into product cycles that aren't 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks. We're back to waterfall cycles. We're back to 6 months, a year. How do you meet those requirements to allow people much more control of what they want? And I won't use the word customization. I think configuration is the word that we should be using here.
That is the word, yes.
How do you allow them to do that, but at the same time keep the commoditized focus so that you keep costs down?
right on top of the key issue, and this is what I spend almost all my time on. Because the history and the knowledge and everything we bring from IBM contains the yes to everything, and then the pressure of uniformity, repeatability, efficiency, all of that of cloud are kind of at a collision point. And so we turn to engineering and some very specialized engineering to how do we improve the basis of the cloud? What's in the fabric of the cloud such that we can get that configuration? And I look at it this way. One of my big goals here with this infrastructure and as we evolve it is to say, how do I let people do the things that they already know how to do? And this could be in their persistence layers and some of these big heavy databases, and I'll call them legacy applications and all, because to change those is too big of a lift for them to get over the mountain, so to speak. So I want to let them run those things, but I also want to let them innovate. Horizontally scalable, do the AI stuff, do the analytics, do all these other things, and how do we blend these environments? To date, the answer has really been run this stuff over there, maybe keep it on-prem or go to an enterprise cloud, and then do these things in a commodity cloud because it's different and I can get different pricing. We've been focused on how do we serve that spectrum out of the same platform. And that's why you see our legacy coming into here is bare metal. You really want to control everything. You've got top performance. There's nothing in the way, all the way through virtual servers, VMs, and now containers and those kind of things. So now you have choice on where you go, but it's all delivered out of the same infrastructure. So now we get scale, we get utilization, we get efficiency, and we've done a lot of work. This is one of my jobs here for the last about a year and a half in the Cloud Innovation Lab. Has been how do we change that foundation so that we can make that even more efficient, faster, and better in that. So I think you're exactly right. The answer is how do we let people do what they want without making it terrifically expensive to get there? And that's, I will tell you, it is possible, but it takes a lot of engineering. It takes a lot of operational savvy to get there.
It's interesting. I've been at OpenStack all this week, and one of the key focuses there has been this move back to simplicity, back to little building blocks that we can add in, but people can just take out when they don't need them. And one of the big reasons for that is they've got people who put in OpenStack just 4, 5, 6 years ago, who now have what we think of as a legacy issue. Because they heavily customized, they can't do rolling updates when they come along. How much of that is a challenge in educating customers when they move to cloud, that they've got to not just re-architect apps, but they've got to actually re-architect their thinking?
It's actually something I see all the time, because I go and I meet with our customers and we explain the transformation we've gone through internally and then the process we're taking different of our clients through all of these. And they look at me and they say, we love that. We think that's awesome. Our problem is we don't know how to do that. I agree with you. That's a great thing. And I look at my team and I say, I don't know how. And so that is one of the big areas to unlock the growth in cloud, even more than it is really that transformation. I don't know if you've been to Blue Mix garages and those kind of things where we actually work with the customer. They'll bring in a problem and it's a agile development. We go and they walk out a day later with a running solution to their problem. Maybe it's not quite production ready, but at least they get through the process. And that becomes a big eye-opener and a really recognition that they can do things better. This is a huge point, even internally. Part of our evolution in the cloud focus that I've had is to that really embrace DevOps. Really, what does it mean to say that our global cloud platform is going to be updated 3 times a day? And tying that together, as well as doing all of the technological innovations and investments in here. I'd like to say about half of the work has been on cultural and really bringing the teams along to get into that framework of what it means to be agile and not the, yes, I'm following an agile process, but to really incorporate it into the culture, your daily life, and moving forward.
Part of the challenge of that then, it becomes density and utilization of assets. VMs consume a lot of asset, but they're not necessarily as dense as we'd like them to be. There's a lot of duplication, a lot of wasted process time. We're moving to containers, but that also requires a re-architectural think by companies. They've got to start thinking, what is a container? What's in a container? What are we actually delivering? What's a microservice? How do we decompose our applications? When you start to look at your estate of equipment out there, what level of change do you see in terms of utilization as you move people away from VMs and into containers?
It's actually a great point, and it's a big focus within the cloud unit here. I look at containers as another level of virtualization. So a lot of the same concepts apply in terms of how you manage it. And then there's this spectrum, the revolution from doing a server per application and all was actually really into virtualization was actually an amazingly simple thing to see. But it really came down to the speed at which the computers are evolving. Moore's Law in action. And so for $1,000, you can buy a massive machine and almost no applications could actually use it all. But the wrapper was the OS, and then the OS was bound to the machine. And so even if you're only going to use 5% of the machine, you would never share it with anyone because they're going to want to change a driver or update something, or they're going to change a library and you're going to be messed up. So it became the boundary of sharing was a machine.
1990 all over again.
1990 all over. The stunning obviousness of saying, well, almost none of your applications use one of these now monster machines, even though they're cheap. Chop it up, then lie to everyone. So you have your own OS and the whole thing. And because you're only using fraction, pack 20 of them, pack 40 of them on a server, bang, away you go. So then you look and you say, well, what's, just to your point, what's efficient, what's inefficient? And you say, well, geez, we have a copy of everything. We're running all of the schedulers. We're running all of these things over and over again. And what are applications really doing? And it comes down to effectively a thread. I mean, a process. There may be a few, but it doesn't matter. Why am I carrying these other 100 processes in every version of what we're doing? We announced at Interconnect our new Kubernetes service, so on Docker, container service, and then really a big refactor of our services and applications to take advantage of that container environment. And so the influence is, it's good for us. Again, for me and the infrastructure, everything we do really focuses around the efficiency of the infrastructure, and then that translates to utilization, and then it gets all the way back into just-in-time delivery and all sorts of other things. So we go all the way back deep into the supply chain, but then when you come up to the top end, the I'll call it the hotter, and I don't really mean temperature-wise, but the more dense that we can run, the better is for us because we deliver more value per unit of capital that we're putting in. The container work and that evolution or revolution is creating opportunity for higher utilization and just more efficiency across the board because it also reduces storage and all these other things. The challenge in here then is, of course, it's isolation security, and then you'll see that there's some pretty significant changes to the demands on the networking and even the storage subsystems, because one of the amazing shifts in the IT world was virtualization broke a lot of things. And I would say one of the biggest damaged areas was networking. Because effectively, up until that time, you managed your network at the port level on the switch. There is a server at the end of this port, and I can allow, disallow, I can do some things associated with that. Now, virtualization comes along, plops a hypervisor on, and now there's 20 machines at the end of that single port. So now even how you manage and think about it suddenly all has to change, and then there's this fight about things are in or out in the hypervisor, what does it mean? And then as virtualization evolved, and now we have live migration, vMotion, all of these things, the problem got worse all over again because not only is it the machine's one of 20 at the end of this port, but now the machine's at some other port somewhere else, and this whole SDN thing got, I'll say, messy along the way and very complex, mainly because people are trying to maintain standards and use same protocols, and it's a fairly restricted environment given the dynamicism that's happening now. Now, you take containers, and I love this a lot of ways. In some of our early days, we deploy containers in VMs because we still get a better isolation. We get some security controls. There's all sorts of other things on there. But now you take one of those 20 things and you put another 10, 20, 50 disparate things inside of that. And now you have immense challenges in terms of where things are. How do I address them? How do I talk to them? How do I secure it? How do I, and here's an important one, manage the performance and the bandwidth associated with it?
That performance and bandwidth becomes even more complicated with a new generation of applications. You talked about moving those bottlenecks around, be it network, be it CPU, be it memory, be it storage. All of those things have been bottlenecks to the application on top. But we've got new generation of applications coming along, and it's rather apt that we're sitting here in the Watson building. We've got AI, but we've also then got a hardware shift going on underneath with the GPUs with power, where we're offloading massively parallel tasks to GPUs which are ideally suited for them. But they themselves will stress the rest of your environment from a cloud perspective. So how do you begin to bring AI into cloud and at the same time deliver the right level of isolation from other customers to stop things becoming the bad neighbor? You really don't want this application taking down everybody else on that shared box. it's going to be a complicated dance for you.
It is. And I love the way you brought that up because, again, we are IBM. The Watson and cloud are what's driving everything that we're doing here. And we have some advantages. For all intents and purposes, we created AI and really how to drive it forward. And so there's a lot of history, a lot of knowledge about what's required. And just as you bring up the memory bandwidth to the GPUs or the I/O bandwidth, how you connect them, a lot of pressure on the system. And then as we accelerate different parts of the system, just to your point, the bottleneck now moves, how do we transfer intermediate results between nodes? How do we do all that? So suddenly there's pressure on the networking. Then we have to load and store permanently data sets, and now the pressure's on the storage subsystem. Because we're very focused on the cognitive space, data first with the cognitive, all of those other things. And we've been running a very large scale cloud, global scale cloud. We've really spent a lot of time looking at what it means to enhance the cloud infrastructure to be the best cloud to deliver those kinds of services. So to get very specific, just going down those paths, as we see 100x time in terms of the compute power, as we introduce GPUs into there, you can make a calculation about what happens to your network in this case. We've done a lot of work, a lot of innovation in enhancing the network interconnect between these servers to both obviously increase the bandwidth, but also decrease latency. This has been a big focus. Same thing for storage. You still need now to have very high performance connectivity to your storage and again, low latency because it's great that now suddenly things are 100 times or 1,000 times more powerful. But if it takes 10 minutes to get your data there to start, you've really not done much for your overall work.
Getting some of that data there to start, though, is challenging across multiple architectures. The one architecture we haven't mentioned yet is Z. We know that people are connecting to the systems of record. We know that one of the things that cloud is doing is it's allowing them to build new generations of applications, mobile applications. We've taken away many of those end tiers to make it a very simple tiered solution. We still have a middleware, but it's not what it was 5, 10, 20, 25 years ago. We've seen power come in. We know Intel's inside SoftLayer. We know you're talking about bringing other processors and other architectures in. We know the importance of mainframe from the cloud perspective. It's something that IBM's been pushing hard. And now, of course, it's gone to the open mainframe community. When do we start to see IBM itself deploy Z systems or Linux One inside SoftLayer instead of just at the moment leaving it to third parties?
You're already seeing this happen. I think earlier you talked to some folks about blockchain and how we implemented that. That is using mainframe systems to carry out the secure processing, the encryption, and actually the core of blockchain. And we've been integrating and now hosting those systems inside my data centers. It's actually already begun that migration. And I think you're going to see, as we go forward, more and more integrations like that and capabilities, particularly as we leverage the power, the trust, and the capabilities that we see across the board. And some of the leading indicators about how things are evolving, if you look close at what's happening in the Z, where they're moving to standardized racks and deployments and things, it makes it much easier to build them in a contemporary data center in a very consolidated and commoditized process. And so I think you'll see some interesting things. The other side of this is if you look exactly what you say is what we see in the mainframe and the capabilities, we call it API Connect, but it really is a gateway that lets the data flow in both directions between these monster systems of records, between those applications and services and capability behind the firewall and the cloud, so that if you try to enhance the cognitive capabilities, there's a way of actually securing the data. So it's not move everything out into the cloud and then you'll be great. It's like, ooh, that's a little scary, maybe a little hard. But really to manage that environment, to bring all of the information and the data, make it accessible as we build and combine these applications. And I have to tell you one of the crazy ones. Just a few months ago, we were going through some of the capabilities of API Connect, and they were talking about how we can put REST APIs on the front end of a number of data sets and services and processes out there. And they were showing very easily how you could do literally just a little tiny bit of work, and you could take your COBOL applications and have REST APIs to be able to activate and interact with it. And I'm like, oh my God, are you serious? And then I was like, wow, that stuff is actually really powerful, because big legacy, lots of data, lots of integration for what's there, but now the stuff is accessible to combine that data, combine that process with new and interesting apps. It really lets people speed up what they're doing and across the board. So there's a lot in here. Let's just say we're paying a lot of attention to this and then bringing this stuff closer and closer together.
One last question. One of the biggest challenges for a lot of people is getting their data into the cloud. there'll be customers out there with large amounts of data looking at SoftLayer and going, I don't have the bandwidth to move a petabyte, 5 petabytes, let alone 100 petabytes or an exabyte of data. How are you beginning to address that for customers, and what can they expect to see?
So there's a couple layers here, and I think you covered that. We look at what customers are trying to do at a variety of different points and capacities across the board. And so we help them, of course, use the network with different compression technology, our spare assets and things like that to speed up transfers and all that. And we're just beta-ing, we call it MDM. It's our ship you a device, you load your data up and bring up those. And so those are our process by which we start increasing the capacity of things we move or can move for the customers. As I say, we see the demand for that increase as well. So I think you'll see just like this, the step forward in terms of more and more data motion and larger capacities. The work that we're doing in our object storage, the work that we're doing in those global services around storage is really, again, going after the fundamentals of cost for your storage and then giving you some trade-off. Actually, probably one of the coolest things that we announced was our flex pricing on object storage. So you have warm, cool, and then cold, and then frozen. I don't know. Everyone's got new names now in terms of how they deal with their data. But if you look at most cloud providers out there, or maybe I should say all cloud providers out there, for object store, they say, well, if you store it here, it's 5 cents. And if you store it here, it's 1 cent. And if you store it here, it's 0.5 cent. And the difference between them is how often you can access them, if you can read it back, and all of these other things. And we were looking at this and saying, well, how do you know for sure what you're going to do? And if you chose wrong, you have to start moving your data between these tiers and then managing it. Is it cached? Is it doing all these other things? You have to do all this work to take advantage of these different tiers. We said, wait a minute. We could actually just change it so you can store it in the object storage. And depending on how you use it, then that would be the pricing for it. And so that was the genius behind Flex. So if you treat it as frozen or super cold or whatever you want to call it, then it's your 1 cent or 0.5 cent or whatever else. And if you start accessing it a lot and using a lot, then it's like cool or warm, you know, whatever the heck you're going to use there. And then you charge your 3 cents or whatever it is. And so it takes the burden off the end user and it puts it on us. And that's probably a hint about how we're looking at cloud. Anytime we can do something that adds value to the customer, where we have to do the hard work, but then everyone gets the benefit, that's what we're about.
John, thank you for your time today.
Excellent. Thank you.